Sloppy Spoilers with your host, Spoilers. DT2. Spoilers. 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 Hello and welcome to Sloppy Spoilers. I'm your host, David Taylor II. You know me as DT2 Comics Chat on Twitter. This episode, we're going to be talking about Stargirl, Season 1, Episode 5. Let me say right off the bat, this show needs to be renamed to Stargirl and the JSA, because that's what it is now. Mm-hmm. We'll dive into that a little bit more. Let me introduce and welcome my co-host. I want to give a warm welcome to Jeff, Dr. Fate Bracey. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello, everyone out there in Internet land. This is Jeff Bracey reporting to you live from lovely Blue Valley on all the misgivings and happenings going down.
Warm welcome to Steve Shadewing Sellers. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, welcome from the JSA Brownstone, and now we're going to dive a little bit into another episode of Stargirl and see what goes from there.
Warm welcome and a welcome back to David Nemesis Howard. Good to have you, man.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be back. And I am here to say that the part of Nemesis today will be played by Thunderbolt. So.
Now, I said it in the intro, bears repeating here. We're going to talk more about it as we dissect this episode. But this show is now officially misnamed. This is the direction that they're going. And it seems like it is. This show should have been named Stargirl and the JSA, because that's what it is now. That's where it looks like it's skewing. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you definitely need to set audience expectations, number one. But number two, we looked at a video earlier this week, and we're going to talk about it during this pod. This episode, if you weren't sure, this episode highlights the fact that Courtney is not the most interesting character, and she does not have any development. What is her arc so far? Okay, she's exactly in the same place she was when we meet her, even though there was a lot of promise and potential there. And she's become a bit of a superhero stalker and a bit annoying, but other than trying to recruit, she doesn't have a personal arc. And so those faults are kind of glaring now. And it's just like it was with the first season of The Flash, even though the younger actors were great. Grant, Candace, Danielle, Carlos, they were great. But it was the veteran actors. It was John Wesley Shipp and Jesse L. Martin and Tom Cavanaugh, and still is. And Michelle Harrison. It's the veteran actors that first season of The Flash that gave the show its bite, its weight, that made us care so many things. That happened. It was because of their performance as well. The same is true here, except they've created the story world where all of the adults, almost all the adults, are villains. And maybe that's supposed to be a bad thing. Maybe that's a dig at being an adult. But all the villains are super interesting. And the heroes, not so much. And there's a reason for that. I'm going to get into that as the episode goes, as we go forward. So I want to talk about the opening scene is a little flashback, and we get introduced to pretty much the last days of Rex Tyler. For those of you listening who may not know who that is, that's the original Hourman. And I mean, they explain that to you later on in the episode, but if you didn't know who that was when you were looking at him and what he was doing. But what I want to point out here that is underscored so strongly in this episode. And also, don't miss the wink to Siegel, because Dugan's address was Siegel Way. Siegel and Schuster, Superman creators. Mm-hmm. Don't miss that Easter egg. What I want to point out here, and it's a generational thing, make no mistake about it. Golden Age and Silver Age characters and the people who created them had them create their own technology. Had them create their own tech. Now, of course, there were some heroes, obviously, that were created by accidents and by discovering alien objects, of course. And some heroes that were created by biology, alien biology, of course. But those that use tech, most of the time, they created it. And those that use science, most of the time, they were the masters of that science and were ahead of their time. But I want you to notice what this next generation does. They're talking about carrying on a legacy, but they inherit tech, and the tech does all the work. That's what jumped out to me a couple episodes ago. But this episode, with the introduction of the new Dr. Midnight and the new Hour Man, the tech does all the work. They don't create anything. The only thing Courtney made was her costume, and even that was from the original costume. They're not making anything like their predecessors, which is a very interesting contrast to me. So you guys give me your thoughts on what I'm saying, the opening scene with the original Hour Man and then leaving his kid with his brother-in-law. That's another one that I'm like, well, okay. But if you're running for your life, maybe we can cut that some slack. I don't know. So give me your thoughts on that opening scene, but also what I'm saying about the generational divide with creating tech versus inheriting tech. Start with Bracey.
Well, I'll tell you, we had touched on that before about how these, we'd hoped these characters, it wasn't going to just be all about their totems. And, you know, I think a potential flaw of the show is that it is becoming Stargirl and the JSA, whereas, you know, Arrow and Flash took the time to, you know, get these characters together to kind of build their relationships and everything before we started kind of like adding to the team, so to speak. And maybe, again, that's a generational thing as well. You know, I've already discussed before, it one of the themes seems to be the age gap, like the us versus them, as far as the youth versus the previous generations. And when you said that, I sort of had an interesting thought, because in the 40s and 50s when they created these characters, you know, they were very impressed not just by people who were extraordinary physical specimens, but also people who had extraordinary minds. You know, we had geniuses like Albert Einstein back then. And so a lot of these characters took the model of the both, like literally the Greek ideal of like the fittest mind and the fittest body. And so these heroes like stood head and shoulders above the rest of us. They were these physical juggernauts, but they also created all this tech. And what do we have with these kids here? They are the equivalent of superhero trust fund babies. They are just being handed stuff with no idea what to do with it. And I think we can all say we've seen how poorly that tends to go in the real world out there. So, and this episode actually exploits how that's a bad thing, which is something I actually had hoped to do and predicted. As far as the scene itself, leaving the kid behind with his brother-in-law, you know, he had no chance. He had no choice on that, really, by way of the setup. So I was okay with that. The thing that was a little sad for me is seeing that it appears that Hour Man is, in fact, dead, that he gets killed by Grundy. And I was hoping, because he survived the initial slaughter, that maybe somehow he got away. And we would see OG Hour Man sometime in the show, but it looks like that's not to be.
Superhero trust fund babies, I love that phrase. And it's 100% spot on. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I actually kind of like that thought there. It kind of reminds me of this multiversity story by Grant Morrison, which was about like the children of the JLA and all of this. And they actually are basically acting like trust fund babies that have been handed everything, and they're a bunch of bored celebutards. I don't think that this is that bad, but I can see the comparison with that. And definitely, I do kind of have a problem with all of these heroes basically being handed all these totems and just being in the right place at the right time, as it were, or being chosen by the totems. In the case of certainly Courtney, and also as we find out, Dr. Midnight is basically chosen as well. I just don't get this feeling like these characters are earning it or working for it. It's just basically they happen to be there, and that's kind of unfortunate. The other point that I would add is that I'm getting a lot more of a comparison to the Scooby gang in Buffy. Like, essentially what's going on is it's not necessarily, you know, just about Buffy, but about her relationship, you know, to the Scoobs. And I feel like this is another case of Stargirl, like, taking influence from Buffy, at least in the setup. So now we kind of have Dr. Midnight, who is basically the Willow of the group. You know, you're going to have Hourman, who is kind of the tough guy, you know, and you've got, you know, Pat, who is sort of the Giles of the team. And so there are various, you know, where's where that's connecting. As far as the situation with Rick, I was kind of disappointed because I'm just kind of getting the feeling, because my big problem is, why in the world would Rick's mother trust this loser? I mean, because we see nothing redeeming about him. He's a drunk, and, you know, clearly it's kind of implied that he's taking, you know, his anger out on Rick because of whatever he's drinking. And, you know, he feels that Rick is a burden. And this woman is saying, oh, well, you have to trust him, Rex, trust him with our child. But you're not showing me any reason why the parents would trust this guy.
Yes. They must have had no other option. I think the woman says that, you know, nobody else we could trust or whatever, but still, should have been somebody. Go ahead, Nemesis.
I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying as far as it's starting to get a little ridiculous how many people are in this town that happen to have the exact right qualities to inherit these various totems or whatever else is going on. It's like, what the hell is going on in Blue Valley? You know, it's like everybody is there for some reason and happens to be able to inherit this power. I also think it's a problem. They could possibly write it into doing some good things when we talk about Hourman, the new Hourman, a little bit later. I think there are some interesting things they could do with that character. It depends on what they decide to do, and I'll reserve judgment on that. I do want to give them a shout out. The show continues to have some phenomenal Easter eggs in it. Another one that I noticed that I was really excited about was the fact that Rex Tyler's wife is named Wendy Harris, which is a shout out all the way back to the original Super Friends when you had Marvin and Wendy and One Shot. So, you know, nice. That was really cool. I thought that was a cool thing to see. As far as Rex and Wendy leaving Rick with the uncle, I got it. You know, it definitely was a contrivance, a way to have this horrible uncle come in and then raise him badly, and he's a drunk and everything else, which, you know, then shapes Rex into being Rick into being the person he is. Now he's Iron Man and he's got rage issues and everything else that goes along with it. It's a very obvious plot thread. As we've stated here on a number of different shows, we see the code and how, you know, why they wrote it the way they did. But it didn't bother me that much. There are other things in this episode that I did have problems with, but I think this one was definitely a mixed bag, the episode couple.
Just on pure physicality alone, I'm not buying that Courtney is carrying around all of the JSA totems in that duffel bag, nor that fits in the half court high school locker, because we had full lockers that were the full length, the size of a student, and these are half size lockers. There's no way the lantern alone wouldn't fit in that, no less everything else that she has. And so I'm calling just chicken crap on that. And then we talked about it before, but what the show is doing is it's undermining its own credibility based on Courtney's actions. And I don't know if that's a troll. I don't know if it's bad writing. I don't know if they didn't think it through. But they're making it impossible for us to take seriously what she's doing. And I'll tell you why. And we talked about it when we mentioned the Scooby thing. This is basically now a live action cartoon. And what I mean by that is, I mean classic cartoons before the 90s. Before audiences got more sophisticated, we would just meet characters and they'd have adventures, and that was good enough. we didn't have necessarily have backstory. We had an enjoyment out of watching them just react to the situation. For example, classic Scooby-Doo is formulaic. It's absolutely a formula show, but it's a formula that worked and a formula that we love. It wasn't until much later until we started talking about, you know, Velma's sexuality and how come they always got the same clothes on and Shaggy must be high all the time. And where did they get the money from? The job machine. And how come they ain't in school? And on and on and on. All that came later. Before, we just saw characters that had adventures in the classic Hanna-Barbera days. And that was good enough. That's what this episode is. And I'm really hoping they don't turn the show into that because it's undermining. We can't take it seriously. If you're going to tell us that all it takes to be a superhero in this world is for Courtney to decide that you are, or for you to be in the right place, right time, or just anything that we've seen so far, then that's a cartoon. And they had such depth and such characterization. And again, I remember I told you that when I'm wrong, I'll be the first to admit it. I was wrong about Luke Wilson in this role. He has brought it. He has brought the heart of Pat Dugan. He has made you care more than anybody else on the show. And he's the one that is kind of our connective anchor towards the classic JSA and Courtney's life now. All because of him. But what the younger players are doing, man, is just feels empty. So anyway, let's transition into actually meeting Rick and who he is, and this whole chance meeting that they have on the road, and how he happens to have this conversation with Pat about cars and carburetors, and they happen to bond, and Pat happens to ask him the color, and just so much convenient contrivances. But Rick as a character felt to me a little bit like he's trying to be Dylan from 90210. And, you know, rest in peace, Luke Perry. But Luke Perry did it better. Mm-hmm. He felt like he's trying to be the broody, sexy, angry guy. The problem now is that we are all old enough to have seen these tropes before and we've seen them done better. So when we meet these characters, unless there's an effort put in the writing to give them a twist we haven't seen before. I'll give you some examples and then I'll hear from my co-host. I'll give you an example. I've been referring to Firefly all night, but it's one of the best examples I have. For example, River is the manic pixie dream girl, but her twist is she's a weapon and she's crazy because of something that was done to her. Because she is not actually crazy. She's damaged. Okay? Inara. The twist on Inara is that they lived in a time where being a professional companion was the respectable position, and it wasn't like people might view prostitution now. And she was the one that used her presence and her respectability to get them out of many situations. And Inara's twist to that was that she was dying. Okay? And they just never got to play that out. So each one of these tropes and characters and stereotypes had something about them that makes them unique enough for us to want to follow them through the series. And I'm not seeing that so far here. So talk to me about Rick and talk to me about, you know, just your vibe from him and how they meet him and who he's trying to be. Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, I agree with you. We've seen all these tropes before. And this character of Rick is, you know, he's an amalgamation of a number of these different characters. It could be Dawson's Creek, it could be 90210, it could be any number of things, but we've seen all of this. And that's where I am starting to get a little worried, because we're adding more and more teenage characters, and each of them are fitting neatly into a stereotype or a trope, and we're not getting a whole lot of backstory with them, and I'm worried that they're going to start eating up more screen time, and some of the good stuff we've seen with Pat and Courtney is going to fall by the wayside. So, you know, I'm going to say that there are some red flags on the horizon, possibly. The character of Rick, like I said, I think there are some interesting things they could do with him. I don't want to give too much away yet, because the interesting stuff, I think, comes towards the end of this episode, and so I want to talk about it then when we get to that scene. But yeah, I mean, he's a classic bad boy. At one point, watching this opening scenes with him and the stuff he's doing, I was expecting him to suddenly morph into Judd Nelson and throw his fist in the air. So that's really good.
Okay, now I am not going to be able to get Stargirl the Breakfast Club out of my head. Just to let you know there, bruh. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Steve.
Oddly, the Breakfast Club character I was thinking of was Charlie Sheen. I mean, he definitely has that Charlie Sheen kind of look to me. And I would also go a little farther back beyond Luke Perry and look into James Dean. Like, there are just moments like when he's walking, he just looks, has that James Dean kind of look. So I have a feeling they're just kind of looking towards that leather-bound bad boy type of character, especially when you like have him in the bar stalking his uncle, and you know the whole thing looks so 40-ish. So I'm really kind of got that whole vibe from him. There were kind of moments with him I thought were okay. Like I liked the bonding with.
Like Steve was about to say, the only thing I really liked about this character so far was his bonding experience with Pat. You know, they got together over the idea of cars. Pat's obviously got a classic car, and he was bequeathed a classic car by his father. And so that was a really nice moment, because everything else you see with the character is just kind of like, oh, man, there's not a whole lot to like here. I understand the relationship with him and his pretend father, his uncle. But him treating everybody else like crap just because of that is like, it's a little bit hard to swallow that he would have never found anybody else to talk to in all that time, that he would never had any friends, no real friends. Instead, he has kind of become that character from the Breakfast Club, even though he looks more like the wrestler. He's acting more like the drug dealer, like, oh, man, I'll get the underage kids the beer, you know, I'll hustle here, I'll hustle there. And so that makes him very unlikable.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, because this continues to go on with a theme for me of the episode, is how stupid Courtney is in this episode, because she is brick dumb this episode. It's like you talk about how there's no growth. I actually feel like she's regressing. Because she tells, like, Pat the car is bringing, oh, I'll just walk home. The car is facing one direction, and she goes in the opposite direction, because that's where the boy just walked off, and he has nothing to say about it. Because maybe he thinks, like, oh, maybe she thought the kid was hot or something, but, like, it never comes up, even though she's carrying, like, 100 pounds of gear with her, and she walks for miles with it.
Right.
Yeah, like, it's no wonder he could tell you were following her as you're clinking and clanking all the way down the road.
With really, a Green Lantern battery.
Yeah.
I know. It's like just the I'll dive into that a little bit. Like, she is so recklessly stupid this episode that she kind of pissed me off this time around.
Oh, man. For me, it was the contrivances. Like, okay, the car happens to break down there. Well, we've never seen any indication that the car has ever broken down over anything. But no, it breaks down right there. And it just happens to be right in the path of Rick as he's walking by. Oh, how convenient. I mean, and there's like convenience after convenience throughout this entire episode. And that's just one of them.
Now, I agree with everything you guys are saying. I really like the James Dean reference. We've seen this trope before, and I didn't realize how much like that he was until you said it. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty spot on. And so, again, if they don't introduce anything, any type of unique twist, then, we've seen this all before. Now, I want to move on to the other character that's featured in this episode, and I have quite a bit to say about her.
Oh, boy.
But I definitely have you guys' thoughts as well, and that would be Beth Chappell. Now, for those of you listening to the pod, if you are not comic readers, you need to know that there have been three people that have been Dr. Midnight. Charles McKnighter was the original Dr. Midnight, and he created all the tech, and he was blinded by a grenade when he was young. He was also a surgeon, but it kind of gave him powers to see in the dark, and he created special goggles. He was a precursor to Daredevil because he was invented in 41. So very much that handicapped idea. He was probably one of the pioneer characters that had a hero with, you know, what we used to call a handicap and some type of physical impairment. And that gave him powers and was the impetus to him actually becoming a hero. For those of you that are not familiar with the comics, that's the original Dr. Midnight, Charles McKnighter. Beth Chappell from the comics was also a medical doctor. Okay. And she was dealing with a crisis during dealing with Jade from Infinity Inc. and got rushed to the hospital because Jade was suffering from the side night touch of Mr. Bones. But Beth got blinded as well by an explosion. She was rescued by Owlman's son, Rick Tyler, who we meet here. And then, long story short, Beth becomes the next Dr. Midnight. She also got special vision and the goggles and everything. But she was an accomplished person. She ends up dying later, and then she's brought back in Doomsday Clock, a whole bunch of stuff going on there. But anyway, but that's who she is from the comics. Here, she's kind of just of an annoying geek kid. And it's not that her character is unrealistic in terms of we all know people like that, and we probably used to be her on some level. And so she's relatable on that level, but she's just kind of annoying. And then what Steve said, the contrivances, she stumbles on the dog chewing a mask, and then she stumbles into Courtney's room, and then she stumbles up on the goggles, and then the goggles automatically respond to her. Would they have responded to anybody? Is that how she becomes Dr. Midnight? Now, probably what's going to happen is she's going to get blinded before the season is over. It's probably going to be a big accident, and she'll get blinded then, probably. But I'm saying as we meet her now in this context, she's just annoying, and she acclimates so quickly to all of that data. Most people would be freaked out and snatch them goggles off of their head. When you look at Tony Stark, Tony Stark took some time to train in his armor, and he had Mark I, Mark II, and Mark III armor that we saw in the first film, and he had to learn how to read his readouts, and he had to tweak his tech, and he had to learn how to fly, and he had to be able to control his repulsor blast, and on and on and on. She just puts on the goggles, and it feeds him all this data, and the goggles are omnipotent. They know everything. They know stuff that wouldn't be in a database.
It's Google Glass.
right. It doesn't make any sense for goggles to know. So I'm like, so now Nemesis did something on an earlier pod that I really, really liked. And so I want to start doing it more often. He said, let's start examining things through a geek filter. How do we feel about the book to screen translation just from a geek point of view? So just from a geek point of view, I feel like the character of Beth Chappell has been minimized. I realize that she's a woke character before wokeness became a thing because Dr. Midnight was a white man. So, of course, she has to be a black woman. I get all that. But she was a doctor. She was accomplished. There was more to her than what we've seen here, which is why you hear me say on Twitter all the time, people need to read comic books and you need to read the original comic books. You need to understand the backstory. But just in terms of the book to screen translation, I feel like this is such a poor service to her. And I'm like, do you really think anybody's going to like her with this characterization? But anyway, so let me hear what you guys think about that. Start with Nemesis.
Well, I'm glad you came to me because I really want to talk about this character because Lord help me. I really don't want to say this. It brings me no joy. I like Stargirl. You know, or which, as it should more accurately be called, Stargirl in the JSA. But I hate this character. I really hate this character. And it took me until this episode to figure out why I can't stand this character. And it's because they have brought a female version of Urkel and put Dr. Midnight's character. I was waiting for her to be like, did I do that in the middle of this episode? And it's just sad. And to be honest with you, it's pandering of the worst sort. I just can't stand it. She's so one-dimensional. And in this episode, they do give her about 2.5 minutes of introspection where I cared about the character, and then she went right back to being critical again, which made it even worse. Because at one point when she's talking to herself, we got some backstory on the fact that her parents aren't around and she's trying to put this brave face on it and be happy for everyone and everything. And so I started to empathize with the character, and then they just bottled all that up and went back to her being a doofus, a complete dork, and not in a good way. There are dorks that are enjoyable to look at. There are dorks that are just horrible people, like Mike, Pat's son. And then there is this, which is just, and once again, help me. I know there are people that loved, what was that show? Family Matters, was that it? That
had Urkel? Yes.
I know there are people that loved that show and loved Urkel. I wasn't one of those people. I'm sorry. But when Urkel came on and started doing all those things and did the high waters and everything, I was like, somebody slap that kid and put some bass in his voice and let him be a normal person. Because right now, he deserved to just be not on the screen. I couldn't stand it. And I don't know how people watched a lot of it. But this is even worse because they've turned Dr. Midnight into female Urkel. And I'm like, please, please. Get past this as quick as possible so that we could have some real character development, because there's something there under the water that could be interesting, but I'm having some really bad like Picard level flashbacks on what could possibly have, or premonitions about what could possibly happen if this goes all sideways.
Now, you said something that I want to touch on and then I'll go to Steve, but you said something there that was quite profound, and it made me realize something. Because you know how something tickles at your brain, and then somebody says something to make you realize what's been tickling your brain? Mm-hmm. You said the phrase pandering in the worst way. So let me say this. This show is trying to convince us that these kids are fringe kids. The shows that did that better and or properly are My So-Called Life and Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want anybody to be offended by my terminology. I'm just talking about phrases used during the decade or the time of these shows. So anybody listening, I'm not trying to be offensive, but I am trying to be period specific and accurate. My So-Called Life was about the fringe people. The fringe people, and the most mainstream character there was Sharon Chersky. She was a cheerleader, she played in the band, and she was dating a jock. She was mainstream, but Angela, Rayanne, Ricky, and everybody else they dealt with were fringe characters. And what I mean by that is not the pretty people, not the mean girls, not the plastics. That's what I mean, just like in Mean Girls. Same with Freaks and Geeks. But this show is trying to convince us that that's who Courtney and Yolanda and Beth are, and no, they're not. Especially Courtney. Courtney's the cheerleader. She's a Hayden Panettiere type. There's no way she's fringe. No way she's any of what the show is trying to make us believe that she is. And I finally realized that's what's annoying when you said pandering in the worst way. Because there's no way, they say that Beth is the founder and only member of the We Love the Teachers Club or whatever. She's such a nerd. She founded a club. She's the only one in it. I'm like, no, she would have something else going on. But I'm saying they're just trying to make us believe that, these are the outcasts or the rejects, or they don't sit in the center of the cafeteria or whatever. And Courtney could be with that crowd with a pop of her fingers anytime she gets ready. Her mother's Amy Smart, for crying out loud. So, I'm just not buying it. It just really... And Nemesis helped me realize why it's irritating me so. Because if you want to make a show about fringe characters that end up getting superpowers, I'd love to watch that. But that ain't what this is. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Oh, I have to agree. This character annoyed me a lot. And I'm not one of those people that, you know, gets very easily irritated with characters, and we've seen that. But this particular case, it was just like they were trying too hard to make this character likable. They were trying so hard to make her so cheery and nice and friendly. And, you know, and it's just so much that it feels inauthentic and it feels annoying. Not to mention that this character will not shut up. And it's just, and there are characters like that that are good and that are well written. Jeff Johns has even written one, Cyclone. Okay, so you know she's a character that is very much a loudmouth, but you know she's endearing. This character is not endearing. She is just completely chalkboard down the nails down the chalkboard annoying. And I think they're trying to make her into kind of like the Willow character, you know, at least in terms of she's the smart one. But she comes across as somebody who is trying to show off how smart she is by constantly pointing out every single thing that she can. You know, like every little factoid in the world, either that stuff that the goggles is giving her, or just stuff that she knows because she is like so naturally smart. And it's just like she comes across as a know-it-all. She comes across as an annoying loudmouth. She comes across as somebody who is insincere, so nice that she's insincere. And all of these things just add up to a character I do not want to spend time with. And any of those things by itself would not be that bad. But when you throw them all together, it's like, I want her out. And then it just feels like she's forcing herself into the whole situation. Yeah, I was pointing out that she's forcing herself into the lives of these characters. And before that, she wasn't even anybody who cared until she saw Portney flying on the cosmic staff. So, I mean, her reasons why she's involved in this come across as annoying. Just everything about her doesn't work.
It sure doesn't. Go ahead, Bracey.
All right. First of all, I would like to defend Urkel. And here's why. I actually liked Urkel as a character on Family. Was it Family Matters?
Yeah.
Yes. Because he was an underdog. He was an optimistic underdog, which this girl is not. And much like the comic book Dr. Midnight, second generation, or was it she third generation? Urkel was also accomplished. He was quite the science student. He came up with a lot of interesting things during the course of the show. Unfortunately, this character has absolutely none of that appeal. She is Urkel without any of the charm or any of the talent. She is just that annoying outsider kid. And that's really unfortunate. And as a matter of fact, if she didn't have that one moment where you see that, like, well, you know, maybe her nerding out all the time is her putting on her brave face. For the most part, I actually find her character a little creepy. She exhibits some very stalkerish behavior in this episode. And her parents are her best friends. No teenager's parents are their best friends. If your parents are your best friends, something has gone horribly, horribly wrong. You know, like her mom's a doctor. She obviously like, hey, you know, I don't know if this is a phase. She's going to growl. Like, maybe you want to have her talk to a counselor. This is getting a little weird. Her character is really sad. Her character is disappointingly sad on top of being annoying. And as for little Miss Courtney, you guys ever seen Mean Girls?
Yes.
Yeah, like, there's no way Courtney's fringe. The Mean Girls would come looking for Courtney the first day she was in school.
Yes.
You know, and, like, then all these nerdy kids, like, don't hang out with the plastics. That's how that would go down. And, honestly, if you want to see a good show about disaffected teens with superpowers, you need to check out Misfits from 2013, a great British show about these delinquent teens who accidentally get superpowers. Much better idea of what they're trying to do here. But unfortunately, this episode's writer is just misfiring on every single cylinder. I've largely enjoyed the show up till now, but this episode has been a great disappointment for me. And this character in particular, if you You're not making me like the character. I just do not like the character at all right now.
I think it's what Nemesis said last pod. It's life experience and empathy. To have been through situations so you know how to write people that are in them, as opposed to guessing what you think it is. Courtney would have been recruited for the plastics by now instead of you know, the main mean girl making an enemy of her, and she's one dimensional as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just very surface stuff. Okay, so we've established what's going on in this episode, basically in the introduction of the new Dr. Midnight and the new Hour Man. What I want to talk about next is something that Bracey touched on earlier, and that's basically the dumb as a brick approach. Because, again, he said that Courtney was brick dumb in this episode. Now, this was a Halloween episode, but the Halloween backdrop is just an excuse for the party and just an excuse for a bunch of things that happen. But the truth of the matter is them recruiting in public and Rick using the hourglass and it lighting up in front of everybody, and Beth walking around with the goggles on, and so many things that they did just out there in public, I'm saying to myself, what are you guys doing? What in the world? How can you possibly? And they say at least twice in the episode, secret identities are superhero 101. And I'm like, why don't you figure that out for yourself? How about there? How about we start with how you're acting right now? And so I just want to talk about the party and overall the recruitment method, because Courtney just becomes a straight up superhero stalker. And I'm like, everything about that is just weird and creepy. Her approach is basically to bird dog someone and make them give in to accept being a part of her team. And what would you do if every time you turned around, here's this girl, and then she reveals her identity and she tells Rick everything that's going on before he even accepts, and, you know, your Hour Man's son, and she just lays it all on him. And the show is rushing to try to assemble the JSA. I understand that. But the way they're doing it, and like I said, just everything out in the open at the party. Remember that the way that Beth got in the mix was because she saw and heard Courtney and Yolanda at the hospital. So how can she then turn around, be using the goggles and watching them do everything they're doing out in the open and not call it out, saying, guys, shouldn't we be careful that somebody sees us? I was just, So let's talk about the dumb as a brick approach to the recruitment in this episode. Let's start with Bracey, since that was his phrase. You coined it.
Oh, yes. Thank you. This has been a good one for me. Okay, let's discuss Courtney's absolute stupidity in this episode. and I could see this coming from the previous episode, but I'd hoped it was going to lead to something better. The fact that for Courtney, as you mentioned, DT, she has not grown. There's been no character arc for her. This is all still a game, even having witnessed the death of somebody her own age, somebody that she had developed a tangential connection with, it bothered her for a moment, and then she's right back into rah-rah cheerleader superhero girl mood. And that sucks. That sucks so bad. She's not taking any of this with the gravity that's required. Even as a teenager, if you've just seen like a supervillain kill a kid from your class, that should have had something of an impact on her. But unfortunately, it didn't. The plot armor has made her bulletproof to character growth. So what's she doing? She casually spreads all these weapons around her room. She puts the thunder pin in a pin cup. You see in the episode, she keeps all this stuff in her closet where anybody, including that asshole little brother, could get a hold of it. And in fact, when she decides, like, oh, mom always caught me with my stuff, when she goes to hide it, she misses an item. She leaves the goggles behind for the doggone dog to chew on. She is recklessly irresponsible, as I said earlier, and I just can't take it. I really can't. Her stupidity is, it just knows no bounds. She just lays this stuff out on people. like, oh, you know, Yolanda, you can be, you know, you can be the Wildcat because I think you're awesome. And, you know, okay, you kind of got the glasses. And you prove you're a little dorky smart and you're somewhat useful. So you can tag along and, hey, you dark brooding guy, guess what? Your dad was our man. And I know you've got all these anger issues, but here, have this superpower. Now, we will see later in the episode that he is tempted to kill his supposed father, his uncle. Mm-hmm. That's two for two. That's two out of three. Yolanda wanted to kill her ex-boyfriend. He wants to kill his uncle. She doesn't vet anybody. She just gives them. She puts a loaded gun in the hands of a monkey and hopes for the best. I cannot stand Courtney this episode. The only saving grace of this episode is every time Pat shows up with Frank.
That's right. That's right. Now, I want you to notice. Now, somebody said this a long time ago, and I'll never forget it, and it became my litmus test. Somebody said to describe Han, Luke, and Leia, but don't describe them physically. Then they said, describe Anakin, Padme, and whoever else was in the Phantom Menace. And everybody realized that you couldn't, if you couldn't describe them physically. They said, that's the difference between a character and a trope. Or a character or not. And it's so true. That became my eternal litmus test. If you don't describe Courtney physically, you can't really describe her other than young. She's 15 years old and acts like a 15-year-old, and that's it. She doesn't really have a personality. The other thing I want to point out before I go to Steve is I want to point out the absolute ridiculousness of how some totems translate to real life use. And maybe Nemesis, you can expand on this. When we get to you, that hourglass, putting it right in the middle of your chest and it's the source of your power, is ridiculous. That hourglass, Spider-Man has a totem in the center of his chest, but his power is in his blood. His DNA has been changed, and so if you shoot at that spider totem on his chest, it doesn't mean anything. Batman has an emblem on his chest, but he uses it as a target to help distract people and make sure they hit the Kevlar underneath so that he's not hit anywhere else so he can withstand the shot. But our man has his power front and center, and it glows when it activates. So how could anyone not know just to break that hourglass and you're done?
Because if I'm not wrong, didn't the original Hour Man take the Miraculo pill?
The Miracle pill. Yep. That's right.
Yeah, and the hourglass was just a fetish. It was just a symbol. Mm-hmm.
Right, sure. Right. But the way they're setting this up, I'm like, no. Iron Man, he has his artificial heart, his tech in his heart to help keep the shrapnel out of his heart. But it's covered up with his armor, and he can shoot blasts out of it. And it's at least functional, but you wouldn't be able to tell by looking at Tony fully armored up that he's got a heart condition. That's something you'd have to know kind of, you know, off to the side. But again, the way this new Iron Man has been set up, I'm like, dude, all it takes is a good shot to the hourglass, and what are you going to do then? I also want to point out from the geek corner that super strength is not invulnerability. What is wrong with these people?
Yes.
If you have super, you know, everybody has listened to this pod. I strongly encourage you to read about secondary powers. Secondary powers are the things that are required to make the main powers work. Without secondary powers, main powers are always a curse. Like the fact that the Human Torch would burn himself up if he wasn't fireproof himself. That's why Superman's power set is so complete, because he needs them all. If you have super strength, you have to have enhanced bones and reinforced muscles. Otherwise, your back would break every time you lifted something. If you're going to punch a car, that doesn't mean that your hand wouldn't break just because you're strong. That's not the same as having steel skin or adamantium bones. So, I mean, the setup is just getting on my nerves. From Geek Corner. Okay, go ahead, Steve. I just have to throw that stuff out.
Okay, I agree with all that, by the way. As far as the whole business with the party, what in the world are they doing crashing this party in the first place? There was literally no reason to do that. They know where he goes to school. They know where he lives. They can find out anything about him because they have the goggles. Why are you crashing the Alpha Bitch's house at her party just to get a hold of Rick? I mean, this is stupid. I mean, when you're talking about Courtney being dumb, Jeff, this is the thing that was dumb that really got me. There was no reason they couldn't have gotten them out of school or somewhere out of the way where they could talk about this stuff if they actually had to. And there were much better ways for them to go about getting a hold of Rick and trying to convince him if they had to do that. Why they had to go to Dragon King's daughter house to do this. And you don't know or trust any of these people, especially when you're concerned about secret identities. And they made a point about this twice. I mean, it's just that was terrible. And that really got me. And the whole business of Yolanda standing outside was stupid and made no sense, especially since Courtney found a Mogwai mask that she was wearing through half the time. I'm like, why in the world is Yolanda not finding a mask, you know, to hide in there? And then on top of that, in the middle of that, they split up. Anybody who's been in a D&D campaign for 5 minutes knows, do not split the party because bad things happen. They got lucky this time, but the fact remains is that they were in technically enemy territory. Anybody could have messed with them for any reason, you know, especially if they had run into Cindy. You know, she could have gotten them in all kinds of trouble, but no, we're going to split up. And not only that, they're splitting up with Beth there, and Beth, who is incapable of keeping a secret because she's constantly blabbing. The whole scene made no sense, in addition to the things that Jeff pointed out, which I agree with, and the stuff that David pointed out, which I also agree with. This was horrible.
Yeah, we expected better. Spoiler alert, Mean Girl number one, Cindy, is actually Dragon King's daughter. Comic readers already know that. But for those of you watching, if you didn't know that, sorry if we blew that one for you. But this is sloppy spoilers. Yeah. So just to let you know. Go ahead, Nemesis.
All right. What I'm going to say about this whole thing is just the fact that I agree with Jeff absolutely that Courtney is not learning anything is dumb. But just the absolute – I understand that teenagers are fearless and think they're immortal. But they also, once they get clued into the fact that there's real danger, it becomes very, you know, teenagers flip and go 180 degrees. So once a young person realizes how perilous their life is, they suddenly realize that I'm young, I've hardly done anything. And then they go the opposite route, which is, holy crap, I could die, you know? And Courtney should have been there a long time ago. All these kids should be. Because they need to have – I almost wish that the Injustice Society would come along and give them all a royal ass-whooping, to be perfectly honest with you, because that's what they need right now. They should have already realized how dangerous they are, the situation they're in is. They've seen that their principal now is the Fiddler. They've seen that everywhere around them, this whole city is full of villains. They should be in oh-shit mode, you know, where we got to lie low and – these other kids that they've recruited to be in the JSA, once Courtney comes in with her whole pitch, which is, hey, the Injustice Society's here, they're running Blue Valley, and they killed my father. Oh, by the way, they killed your parents, too. Do you want to sign up? Those teenagers should be like, the hell? No. Get away from me. You know? It's like, that's insane. Then speaking about the bag of power that Courtney is lugging around town with all the tomes and everything in it, I'm with you guys. I think it's absolutely annoying that she's become the superhero stalker and is handing out power to everybody. One of the first things you learn in the comics is that, and I just can't believe that Geoff Johns let this get past him or something, is that power is earned, not given. It's true in life, and it's doubly true in the comics. When you get power, it is earned, and having responsible use of that power is learned. So power is earned and learned, and they're just getting it and using it willy-nilly with no reason for them to have it other than maybe the basic genetic connection and no abilities. They're not even showing the 2 episodes worth of training that we saw Courtney get. Suddenly, they just know how to do everything. I mean, with Black Cat, I know that was last episode, but suddenly she's the Black Panther walking around and doing all sorts of things, which is just absolutely ridiculous. You know, how much easier would it have been if these totems, if you want to make it so the totems have some awareness or something, and they seek out a person that best fits the, you know, whatever the requirements are. So, for instance, the goggles, they're looking for a tech person with the right personality and everything, and they, you know, they have, you know, we've established that they're almost omniscient, but they have the ability to go through the internet and look at everything and then find her. Okay, that would be a little more believable. Same thing with the hourglass or whatever. But no, we don't do that. No, instead we have Courtney handing out power like that. And then the final thing I'll say is, with the hourglass, yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. And not only that, he's going around wearing it on the outside of his t-shirt. It's a gigantic hourglass on the, you know? It's like, if you're going to do that, at least make him flave it up a little bit, you know? Because it's
yeah,
just
boy. Crazy.
Oh, at least make him flave it up. That's right. That's right. Because I agree with everything you said, man, especially about the power being given versus being earned and what that means for the development of a hero. Now, for those of you comic readers, you understand perfectly what I'm about to say. For those of you non-comic readers, if you want to see the pitch-perfect illustration, maybe even the foundation of the archetype of what Nemesis is talking about, you need to read the original comic book origin of one Peter Parker, Spider-Man. When Peter got his spider powers, Peter reacted like any 15-year-old boy would. He wanted fame. He wanted money. He wanted interviews. He wanted the cameras, the reporters to talk to him. He wanted to show off the things he could do, but he did have a makeshift costume, and he wanted to be important, and he definitely wanted some girls out of the deal. He reacted like an actual sophomore in high school would react. What turned the tide became the defining moment of his life when he let a criminal, a burglar, get past him that he could have stopped when he had the chance, but he felt like he didn't need to get involved. It wasn't his problem, wasn't even that big of a deal. Turns out later on, that very burglar broke into his home and killed his Uncle Ben. And when Peter tracked him down and captured him, he saw him, he took off his mask, he saw him in the light, and realized who this man was, that he had a chance to stop him, and didn't. And because he didn't get involved, now his Uncle Ben was dead. That's when Peter became a superhero. That's when Peter decided to fight crime. That was the turning point, and that is the driving moment behind Spider-Man. That's how you write a teenager turned superhero. He had a tragedy that he could have prevented, and his own hubris and indifference ended up costing him his father figure. And every time Peter wants to give up being Spider-Man, he has to go back to that origin. Okay, that's how you write somebody 15 years old that gets powers, because that's exactly what it would take to make them be as self-sacrificial as Peter is, because he's driven by guilt. Because he could have done something when he had the chance, but he didn't. Okay? That's where that comes from. So now I want you to compare what I just told you to the light of these characters, to Courtney, to Yolanda, to Beth, to Rick. Is any of that depth there? Are any of those turning points there? Now, we do see a touch of it with Rick. We do see that he's also chasing, trying to understand what happened to his parents. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. Yolanda's setup was personal and timely, but it's not really the reason why she's Wildcat. It's just that she ain't got nowhere else to go. That's kind of what her episode proved to us. But I'm saying that if you want to see it done right, Peter Parker is the right idea behind the way somebody 15 years old will react to superpowers. Okay, now next I want to move to, because we've covered most of the episode. Next, what I want to move to is something that has, and Nemesis, you talked about it, so I'm going to let you go first. Something that had multi-layers of ramifications. I don't know if it was intentional or not. What I'm talking about is Rick sees, as we all see, as the heroes in the audience, we all see how his parents actually died. Now, several key things happen in that scene. that I'm going to touch on, and then we're going to let Nemesis go. The first thing that happens is that there's no way the goggles should have been able to do any of what they did. So that gets on my nerves immediately. Because
apparently they borrowed that card tech.
Yeah.
It's just like the scene of Tony's parents dying in Civil War. Where were those cameras? Because that was from multiple angles. I'm sorry. There was not one camera. Those were some awfully strategically placed cameras, especially back during that time. That was not modern day. Well, the goggles, what they know, and the way they recreated the scene, and then they recreated it in 3D, and then they did a 3D projection, and then it looked like green plasma. So I want to point out that the Green Lantern effects ought to have looked like that. That's what I thought of when I was watching the scene. I'm like, well, if y'all ever get around to giving us any type of Green Lantern core anything, it better be at least this good, because that's what it should look like. So I don't know if that was on purpose or not. I don't know if that was a tease. I'm not sure. But that whole scene, and then the reveal, at least revealing to them, because we knew that it was because of Solomon Grundy that the parents were actually murdered. It wasn't an accident. We knew that. But the heroes find out through that impossible recreation of the glasses. And when I'm watching that thing, I'm like, yeah, no way, but okay. It's what Nemesis said about melodrama, but okay, I guess we have to go with it. So I want to hear your thoughts about that whole thing, because I felt like it was a key scene for kind of the wrong reasons, and it's going to need a little bit of retconning and tweaking to give it the legitimacy I think it needs. We're going to start with Nemesis on that one. Let me hear your thoughts.
Well, the first thing I'll say with the goggles and all that and the story and what they're telling is, why are we supposed to believe that Rick is going to believe anything they're telling him? Even with him showing him that stuff, well, what's to say that they didn't make that all up or that's just, you know, a fiction? Why is he believing them? Why does he want anything to do with them? That was my first question watching this. Why would he even believe them? You know, they're telling him all these things, and he's just buying it wholesale. That's number one. Number two, it's quite apparent that this guy has some rage issues, and Courtney gives the rage machine the ability to have super strength and everything. Okay, that's dumb move number one.
For an hour.
Yeah, for an hour. Dumb move number two is then he basically, you know, like you've already mentioned, you know, Yolanda wanted to kill her ex-boyfriend. Well, now he wants to kill, first he wants to kill his uncle, then he wants to kill the people who killed his parents, and he changes his motivations from vengeance. Well, he sounds like he's a perfect setup for a villain, not a hero.
Yes.
And so what I said earlier is there's some interesting things here. I don't want them to do this because I like Our Man, you know, the concept of Our Man as a hero. But if they made it so that he's a problem because he's got some serious character defects and he's going to end up being a villain and they've got to deal with him, okay, that could be interesting. But if he's going to suddenly become heroic, that is so out of character that I don't like that idea at all. And if I was Courtney, I would have waited for the hour to be up and then beat his ass and take the hourglass away. Because there's no way I'd let that psychotic have the hourglass. I mean, that's crazy. So the whole thing is just, there are some serious, like I said, there's red flags on the horizon, and I'm hoping this was just an aberration. But, you know, this character of Rick, this guy, if this was real life, this is like handing the most dangerous, unhinged kid in your school an AK-47 and saying, hey, we want you to be the good guy and make sure everybody's safe. And, oh, by the way, I got $1,000 in my pocket. Please don't rob me. You know, it's crazy.
Right, right. Brick dumb. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I have to say, this really does show, as Nemesis is saying, you know, Courtney's really poor judgment. And I have to say that, you know, in a way, I was kind of hoping that she would do something stupid with it, because that way she would get some consequences for it later. And it seems like, according to the ending, she might. But at the same time, it really doesn't put her in a good light, and it doesn't put him in a good light either. I also agree that the whole thing with the goggles, you know, revealing everything in detail, like how would they be able to reconstruct the parrot's death in that detail? Come on, complete nonsense. And also the whole bit about the when they were doing the discussion with Rick and trying to bring him on board. Oh, well, you know, who did this? Well, I don't know exactly who did this. Yes, you do, Courtney. It's the Injustice Society of America. Why don't you just tell him that? I mean, yeah, it's just the writing on this was so clunky and it was so inelegant and it just didn't make any sense. I think Rick could be have an interesting arc where he starts off, you know, wanting to take out his anger out and then kind of learning about his father and finding something to fight for and then being better later, you know, his Spider-Man moment, you know, I would like for him to find that, but I'm not sure that, you know, if we're going to see that done properly. And then I'm hoping we don't get any more episodes like this, because if we do, I'm going to start feeling very pessimistic in that respect.
Yeah. We hope this is just a one-off. Go ahead, Bracey.
All right, let me dive into this pool of bad and stupid. All right, so continuing on with my theme of Courtney is brick dumb in this episode. Yeah, we already know that she's absolutely trash at vetting people. She's absolutely trash at keeping secrets. She's absolutely trash at not doing anything in public. I mean, for God's sake, she's walking down the halls of the school openly discussing bad guys in town. Yeah, whatever. But no, she gives the rage monster the superpower, and then when she discovers he is in fact a rage monster, I can't reach you with my blonde hair and my cheery optimism. Well, I'm gonna have to take that away from you. You can't have that in the state you're in. Like, really? You're gonna fight him right now when he's all pumped up on super steroids? I'm like you guys, like. Just wait the remainder of the hour, and then you can take it from him like candy from a baby. You got all the superpowers now. No problem. But no, she's going to threaten him with the staff. That's really going to build the relationship between these two. On top of that, the writers have this guy claim at the end. They have Rick say, like, all right, I'll join you. But for revenge. It's like, no. Do the 7 of 9 thing when we discussed Picard. 7 of 9 played Picard. So she could get revenge, but she acted like, yeah, I'm on your side. We're going to do this mission. Rick should do the same thing. He's like, yeah, injustice. Yeah, we'll bring him to justice. We got this. And then Courtney will have to stop him from getting his revenge. That's a much better play than just putting it right out there in the open right away. It's not a workable situation now. And now they've written themselves into a position where they have to deal with that. The glass is recreating the scenario is just completely unexplainable. even with satellites, because they didn't have like the same category of satellites back then, you know, Google Earth and everything, like that could have maybe caught this in the moment. But no, they didn't have that. And so maybe it's a little bit of Alan Scott. We know that these guys did kind of help each other with their tech from time to time from earlier episodes. But here's the thing that struck me. Urkel Girl goes and activates the hologram, and what does it do? And not only does it play out in 3D, but it just, you know, like Steve said, contrivance, it just so happens when he is standing in the perfect place for the truck to be coming right at him. And when Grundy hits it, it comes flying straight at him. And not only does it recreate this in this 3D kind of pseudo 80s grid pattern, but you can see his parents. Not gridded, but they're in the cab, and you can hear their screams. I was like, holy crap, how absolutely horrifying. Yeah, he's going to want to be a superhero. No, he's the Punisher now. Way to go, Courtney and crew. This was a horrible scene that just really encapsulated everything that I've been having a problem with Courtney in the course of this series. Like I said, like she's doing everything right and everything wrong at the same time. I talk about how she's brave and courageous and she's positive and she really wants to do the right thing. But then, like, she's got the teenager thing going on. She keeps making all these really, really dumb decisions. Except in this episode, there's none of the positive. It's just all the dumb as a brick Courtney that I can stand and more. I'm really hoping that they get one of their other writers back on this for the next episode, because this was a real letdown for me.
So, again, so far, I hope they realize that this team is not really interesting. The kids that are playing them, they're not interesting. Yolanda's had the most interesting backstory because it was so true to life. But as a team, they're not interesting. There's nothing compelling about them that's making us want to watch them. They need something that makes it compelling, which is why you've heard me say several times on Twitter, I hope that a Marvel shows up, because a Marvel, by definition, if it's Billy or Freddy or Mary or Black Adam or all of them, will give you the two worlds writing. Billy is both a boy and a man. So he's compelling to watch for that reason alone. How do you navigate that? And from the comics, you know, that Billy and Courtney have a brief relationship. And so that poses a bunch of things, because Billy spends half of his time as a grown man. His body gets supercharged and he's grown with the wisdom of Solomon. So what does that mean? You know, I've already said that Mary should have her own show. She's a perfect character for this day and age and for this demographic. If Freddie shows up and Freddie is his traditional self where he's handicapped and he has to speak his magic word to get his powers. See, just by definition, those characters are more interesting than what we've seen so far with this young JSA they're putting together. So let's move to the end.
Hey, Dave, can I add something to that real quick?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, unfortunately, though, I don't think that's going to happen. I think they've already introduced us to the character that's going to fill that role. You know, it is a character who has magic, and it's a grown character, but I don't understand how it's going to fit into this, and that is in the other, you know, Easter egg that they finally revealed here, which is the janitor is Sir Justin. You know, he's Shining Knight. And so it's like, how is that going to work? So I'm confused. That was something else that I saw in the episode. So Wendy Harris was cool, but... Yeah, it appears we're going to get Shining Knight, but how is that all going to work? I mean, that could be a whole podcast in and of itself. So.
Oh, yeah.
If they give us the Seven Soldiers of Victory, which I doubt, but if they did, that could be an answer to that question. The way I would write it is I would write it, even though it's a well-used trope, it could still be written well, that the Seven Soldiers came back to save the timeline. They came out of time because the Injustice Society wins.
Okay.
The way they've been set up in this show, there's no way they don't kill these kids, because they open with them killing their predecessors. And the predecessors were 10 times better than these kids. So if they were being introduced, I would write it to where it was almost like a Doctor Strange Infinity War thing, where in every possible scenario, the Injustice Society wins and you guys are all dead. You never graduate high school. And so we had to come out of time to try to figure out a way to not make that reality happen. I'd watch the mess out of that. But if they don't do it that way, then yeah, the Shining Knight, out of all characters, I don't quite understand what kind of role he's going to play. So maybe John's has something up his sleeve.
Yep.
But so we'll go to the final scene. Now, we talked about this in previous pods, and the way this episode ends is so frustrating, because literally the most interesting and intriguing scene all episode long, we get just a few minutes of it and then it's over. I'm like, wait, now I know they're going to pick up next episode. At least I hope they do. But I'm saying they should have made the episode about what happens at the end. What happens at the end is finally Pat finds his way into Courtney's room, which Courtney needs some kind of security in that room, man. If you're going to have all the JSA super stuff, I mean, good grief, at least get a trouble alert or something. But anyway, Pat finds his way and the Green Lantern battery is giving off some type of discharge, which would kind of makes sense to me based on the way the batteries and the rings work. He finds the bag and realizes what Courtney has done, and then it's in credits. I'm like, oh. So maybe they're, hopefully, fingers crossed, they're going to make next episode about that. But I think it was Nemesis that said what Courtney did was a desecration.
And that was me.
That was you. Yeah, desecration and grave robbing, I think is what you said. And that needs to be touched on and called out and addressed. And Pat is the proper character to do it, because the sheer power alone with these totems do not need to be in the hands of the way they've written this version of Courtney. She is unqualified because she's going to make a mess of things. She kind of already has. So I want to hear your thoughts about how it ends and where you hope it goes from here, because it, you know, it's a powerful cliffhanger, but I really wanted to see more of that play out. And the other thing is, man, they keep teasing Lanners. I hope, you know, it needs to be Jade, and hopefully Jade and Obsidian based on the theme of the show. But if not, you know, at least Kyle, maybe even Jessica. I don't know. They might bring Jessica and or Simon. I don't know. But I need to see a Lantern, man. Y'all can't keep doing this. I'm tired of this. They do this, you know, on Arrow and the Flash, and they talked about Hal Jordan, and there was a pilot on Ferris Airfield, but he disappeared and nobody's seen him since. Come on, man. But anyway, so let me hear your thoughts on this ending, because it was really frustrating. Start with Nemesis.
I agree with you. I think that Pat's response, if they're going to do it in credits, Pat's response should have been, oh, Court. And he stands up and he has a small display of anger, teasing us for what is going to come in the next episode, because he should be angry. He should be disappointed, frustrated, and angry. And my hope for Pat and these kids and everything else is that Pat goes medieval on, you know, not physically on them, but emotionally on them. And the way that a parent can on a child or an adult could do on a younger child or a young person, in which you just start laying down the law and what all the possible ramifications of their reckless and stupid behavior was. I mean, it could even be to the point where you bring them to tears. And I'm not saying that Pat has to be cruel, but Pat, played by Luke Wilson, has been such an easygoing character here that if they make him lose his temper and seize those totems and say, none of you deserve this power, you stole this, that would really go a long way towards bringing the show back online and showing Pat to be more than just a sidekick, because he's also the voice of experience, and put these kids in their place and give them an idea of the stakes that they're in. Because right now, they're just cosplaying, and it's annoying all of us because we understand the stakes and they don't.
They're just cosplaying. Wow, so well said. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, cosplaying or LARPing, it seems to be in large part like they were treating this as a live action role playing thing instead of as a, you know, actual serious attempt at being superheroes. I will, before I continue on to that point, talk about one thing that was sorely missed from this episode, and that is the Injustice Society and a lot of the stuff going on with them. We had that little thing going on with the Fiddler, and that was okay, but this episode, compared to the last episodes, lacked the depth of the, you know, villains. We didn't see Icicle. We didn't see the Dragon King. We didn't see Grundy or anybody like that. And I really kind of wish we'd seen a little bit more of them, because that is one of the things that has anchored this show when everything else hasn't worked. As far as the ending goes itself, yeah, I'm kind of with you. Pat, I kind of felt was okay, and I'm okay with leaving it as a cliffhanger, because it builds anticipation to say, okay, hopefully Pat will come in next episode and lay down the law and finally kind of, you know, get upset with Courtney over going way over the line here. I think he suspected that she was doing this kind of thing probably for a while, but now he kind of has evidence to confront her. So that's going to be kind of interesting. But at the same time, yeah, if it ends up being that he just doesn't do very much, or if he's a little too milquetoast, that's going to come across as very bad, I think. There's promise for this to be better, hopefully in the hands of one of the better writers, either Johns or James Robinson, who did the previous episode. People who know, what this dynamic should be. And hopefully we'll see that then. But yeah, it just feels like this really was largely a disappointment for the most part, for a number of reasons. But they left enough hope to build on where there's goodwill, where I'm willing to come back and see what happens next. But hopefully they get the execution right.
You said something very interesting there, and that is that all of the goodwill is not gone. That's very significant. So we were hoping that the writing picks back up so it doesn't just kind of burn out any goodwill we might have had as an audience, because we still want to find somebody to root for and we still want to see how things play out. But not if we keep getting annoying characters making brick dumb decisions. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, that's so true, because I can't really hang my hat on any of the kids just yet. Like you said, we thought Yolanda's episode last week was great, established a lot of good things about her character, and so far she is the most interesting character out of all of the teens who are going to be the heroes. Unfortunately, in a group situation here, the follow-up episode, they're all rather bland or annoying at worst. So this, once again, as we have known before, it leads the adults to be the most interesting characters. And I'm not just saying this out of a bias of being an adult myself, just looking at objectively as somebody who is a fan of such material and has been a creator a time or two himself. They're just the best characters. We are excited to see the Injustice Society because they've got things going on. They've got layers to them. They've got depth, whereas the kids who are supposed to be the protagonists of the shows are more or less these kind of one-trick ponies, and that's very disappointing. So in that context, Pat becomes the focus of the heroes for me, for instance. And if he does not absolutely lose his stuff over this. And I did have a little hint of it. I don't know if you caught it, but Nemesis, I felt when he said Courtney, it came out as kind of a growl to me, a low key growl, but it was like he was kind of growling Courtney. And I was like, oh, this is the faint little rumble before the volcano erupts. And I hope he does. I hope he breaks her down. I hope he snatches the rod from her and the rod lets him do it. I hope she's in tears. I hope he just renders all the kids to jelly because they need it. And if our man 2.0 will give him it, I hope he slips on the damn power ring and goes Alan Scott on him and takes it from him or clicks the thunderbolt, something. And he just lays down the law. And this could set up the kid for trying to work his way back into the good graces, back for a chance to support his father's legacy. That's an interesting idea, but he needs to break these kids down because, for one, I am really tired of watching Courtney push him around. It's not just that she is right. There are villains doing villainous things in town, and he's right that we need to approach this carefully. And he gives her these little okay, it looks like there is more going on than I thought. But because she's rushing headlong in, she's got this whole validation of the staff chose me. The staff chose me, and she kind of lords that over him. She's always overstepping his authority in all these situations, sometimes face to face. She just shuts him down. She just takes charge. And that's not a parent-child relationship, even if she's not his biological child. It's time for him to show her who's daddy and who's the little girl. And, he needs to take her toys away and send her to her room for a while. And the relationship's going to have to change, and hopefully the relationship that develops from that will be a better, stronger, and much more respectful one.
Okay, now really quickly, as we close, I'm going to give a few comments, and I definitely want to hear from you guys briefly. But just to kind of sum up, here's how I see it, and that is that the show has so much potential, It has so much potential, and the way this show has been set up. See, I understand why they're giving us the next generation of the JSA, because if they tried to sell a show on characters that were in their prime during World War II, that would really be a hard sell now in any place other than animation. So I totally get it. Mm-hmm. I totally get how the baton has to be passed on to the next generation if this is going to generate any kind of interest, especially in today's society, and especially on the CW and all that. So I get it. I don't have a problem with that. But this show is not going to survive nor reach its max potential if every one of these kid characters is a stereotype or a caricature or the totem or the suit is doing all the work. If there's no reason for us to care about them or root for them, and if there's nothing about them that makes us want to see them win, then we're going to lose interest. We're going to mentally and emotionally disconnect, number one. Number two, there are stakes, but they've been painted in broad strokes. And what I mean by that is the Injustice Society has been firmly established, and the New America agenda, which, by the way, is eerily relevant to what's going on in our country now, because we're not going to be the same country when we come out of all this stuff that we're now in. The election this fall is going to be a game changer, and everything that's happening this summer is going to produce a new America. So it's eerily relevant to everything that's going on now. So, but the stakes are still broad strokes. Until we get some type of personal connection with these stakes, both as an audience and to Courtney and the other JSAers, it's not going to mean anything. But also, there's no way these kids are going to beat the Injustice Gang. The Injustice Gang would wipe the floor with these children. Remember how this show was introduced? It was introduced by them mm-hmm. beating the original JSA. There's nothing we've seen from these kids that gives me half a penny's worth of hope that they could ever beat these villains. That means that between now and the time of the final confrontation, wherever that happens, there's going to have to be a lot of training. And even then, I still won't believe it until a powerhouse member shows up. That's why I keep mentioning the Marvels, somebody on that level, somebody in a Superman weight class, because there's no way these kids could beat Icicle and them, maybe not even Icicle alone. There's no way, especially not the state they're in now. Now, in terms of the prediction portion, here's what I'm hoping happens. I'm hoping that it is Pat Dugan's tutelage and training and him reading Courtney her mail and making them create a JSA version of the Danger Room, that Pat becomes basically Professor X. He transforms these kids from a bunch of young people that don't know what they're doing into a refined team that might stand a chance against the Justice Society, maybe. What I don't want to happen is that when they introduce Johnny Thunder, that everything gets solved by magic. That the Thunderbolt can do whatever is necessary. So in every situation where they lose, he just does a trick, because then he'll be Mixyaz Piddalick. He'll be a mite. He'll be an imp. He won't, you know, he'll just do something stupid and fix the problem, and then we will have no character growth. I'm hoping that is not what happens. What I want to happen is that Pat turns them into a well-oiled machine, and even then, I'm still not going to believe that this group of kids could go against maybe not even Icicle himself without a powerhouse member. So I want to hear you guys' thoughts on predictions on where you think it's going and where you want it to go. And I'm going to start with Nemesis and just let your full geek filter just let it go.
Well, it just occurred to me that if I was going to write this, my hopes and my predictions would be that, first of all, Pat needs to be the backbone, the spirit, and the conscience of this group. That's what I'm hoping for. We talked about Sir Justin. Maybe Sir Justin is the one that's going to train them. He's a knight of the round table. He's got the experience. He's got the marshal's chops, you know, as far as fighting and everything going on. So maybe he's the trainer and comes in. And he's also another, he's not a powerhouse character, but he can fight. and then hopefully we get that powerhouse later on. That's kind of what I'm hoping for, is that Pat provides that steady backbone and that steady influence, and then maybe Sir Justin comes in and we get the training, because I agree that right now these kids can't even handle breaking into a hospital to look at a file, you know, and to look at a record, you know, let alone taking on the Injustice Society. They get absolutely just destroyed, and one or more of them would be killed in the first encounter.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I'm pretty much going along with that. I would like for Pat to be the Giles of the group. You know, the mentor, the guy that's actually pulling them together and telling them what it's done. I would like for Justin also to be part of that. But I would also like to see more powerhouses come in. If Jade comes in, that would be great. You know, somebody like that, because a Green Lantern would definitely be able, you know, to turn the tide to a certain extent. If they can get Marvels in, that would be nice. But, you know, I'm kind of not really expecting that. So a Green Lantern would definitely make sense, Jade or Obsidian or both. I would like to see the Shade show up, because we already know that he's in the background. We know that he's not working with the ISA anymore. So the, you know, him, them finding him and him helping to put these this team in shape, that would be great. You know, there are all kinds of possibilities. You know, characters that could show up to help. But that's kind of like the general things I want to see, because right now these kids can't handle anything, especially the way they're currently written now. They need to be written at least a little bit better, and we need to see them properly trained, you know, go through the ringers, you know, make a few mistakes here and there, but come out of the other side a better team than they started. Because right now, I mean, they're not even getting along that well half the time. I don't feel like, you know, they're even cohesively, you know, want to be a group, you know, beyond, you know, their own interests. So, yeah, they have a long, long way to go before they're anything remotely in fighting shape. But I'm hoping that they get to the point where they become, you know, at least competitive.
At least competitive. That's right. Go ahead, Bracey.
Okay, I don't see any heavy hitters like the Marvels, per se, coming in, because we potentially have heavy hitters in terms of, like, Green Lantern. However, as you guys mentioned, we know the Shade is floating around out there. We've seen Sir Jeremy. I'm all on board for the idea of these three getting together and mentoring the kids, you know, between, you know, Pat, the Shining Knight, and the Shade. You know, who's got his own bone to pick with the Injustice Society. And that sort of thing works out because, as I said in a previous episode, the Courtney's already thrown the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of deal. So we can work that out. Unfortunately, the way things are going right now, I don't see Courtney taking this serious until somebody personal to her dies. And I don't know if that's going to be her mom, if that's going to be Pat's little brother. If I was writing this, if I was going to pull a Whedon on them, I would actually kill off Urkel Midnight here and end up passing. Here's my rationale. I would end up actually passing the goggles to her mother. Now she's invested. Now we have the accomplished surgeon who is Dr. Midnight. It's more befitting of the comics. And then Courtney is personally at fault, because this is somebody who, even though she didn't really want her to be part of the group, she still let her be part of the group. And now she has to own that. Now it's no longer a game. But as we've seen, because the one kid who died had no real connection to her, it was just, you know, I cried for half an hour, then I got over it, and then I was the same old, you know, blockheaded self I've been. So something drastic's going to have to happen. I don't know if it's going to be they're going to have to corral the son of Midnight, or not the son of Midnight, the son of Hourman, and figure things out there. And she's like, oh, man, I've got to really do something about this vetting process. Or if somebody within the group is going to have to get killed. But I think it's going to take something drastic before Courtney as a character takes off. And, you know, speaking of Whedon once again, it might be just the maneuver that's needed. You know, you pull that Agent Coulson thing on the Avengers to draw the team together. Now they have this common bond of pain. And unfortunately for a lot of superheroes, it is some sort of traumatic event that spurs them on to their courageous acts.
Well, if they were going to write this smartly or write it to accomplish what you're saying, they should write it to where it is Courtney's fault, where she triggers the explosion that blinds Beth.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be great, too.
Now, if that happens, then now all of a sudden they have a bond, and it's kind of like Reed Richards and Ben Grimm.
Yes.
You are where you are because of something that I did that I wasn't thinking, and now it's cost you. And although I do really love your idea about passing the goggles on to the mom who's already the medical doctor, that's a fantastic idea, too. But if they're going to keep Beth, that's the way I would do it. Definitely make it be Courtney's fault. That'll be a real, that'll be a somewhat of a Peter Parker moment or hurt the mom. You don't have to kill the mom, but I'd hurt her really badly. And if she got hurt really badly because of something stupid that Courtney did, or I would have it to where Pat warns Courtney to stop doing what she's doing. Then in that same episode, like the mom loses an arm or something.
Yeah.
Or something like that, where there's real consequences and you can feel them, and there's a life change because of
somewhere
that.
Where she's got some responsibility and accountability for what's happened.
Yes, and there's real consequences that stick, not something that's wiped away, not a status quo reset by episodes in, as these things, you know, so often do. The Flash does that all the time. So
there's
definitely ways to write this to where what we're talking about can be accomplished, and all of a sudden Courtney can get serious. There can be real consequences. We can have Beth be blind, and maybe she goes on to become a doctor after that, goes on to great accomplishment, and maybe she stops being so annoying and running her mouth all the time. So there's ways out of this. And I just hope that it's what Nemesis said. I hope that the way it plays out is that Pat is the key. That he's the central figure that's already the bridge between the old JSA and the new, but he's the one that makes the kids take what they're doing seriously, because clearly they're not. And so, yeah, so that I hope that's the way it goes. So we'll see. But like Steve said, there's still plenty of goodwill here. We still want to see how things play out. They haven't soured us completely off the show at all. We're just willing to count this as, you know, maybe a one-off, and maybe things get better as it goes along. So that's going to be it for this episode. I'm still very excited about this show. There's still so many people I want to see show up. So many ways it can go, and we're still hoping, again, that the writing stays at the high quality that we saw at the beginning. So I want to thank my co-hosts for yet another excellent pod, excellent insights and ideas. I want to thank you so much, Jeff. Thank you so much, dude.
It was my honor and pleasure to be here, sir.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Glad to be here. It's always kind of fun, even when there's an episode like this that's not, you know, up to snuff. It's always good to tear it apart and kind of see, okay, how can it be better? You know, what can be done to put this back on track? So it's good to have that experience.
We're writers, man. We see the code. He is the one. And thank you so much, Nemesis.
No problem. Always great. And I will leave all of you with this thought: as fate commands. So.
Okay, we're not gonna start talking because that's a whole nother hour. All right. Thank you so much, audience, and we will see you next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers. Spoilers. Spoilers.